the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there, making $1 million, having some fun, riding the roller coaster life of being an entrepreneur. We try here to bring you a little piece of the mosaic each interview, a chance to you for you to learn a little bit about a great person, a great career, an industry, how someone else did it, and they give that information to you, and I pass it along, and hopefully we can all have a little fun while getting a little more prepared to be a successful entrepreneur. Got a great show for you today. We have Wayne Elliott in the second half of the show. He is, of course, the hero in my book, The Real Environmentalist. Please go get a copy. Wayne has been an environmental hero and has had an amazing career and deserves to be well known. So please get the book. But before that, we have Patricia Chadwick, an amazing career as one of the pillars of Wall Street. And so I'll introduce her in a second. First, got to go buy the book, please. Real Environmentalist. It's been out 2 days now, 3 days. It's already been number one in all three of its categories, and it needs some sales, and I would appreciate you getting it. So go get a copy. Anyway, let's get back to Patricia. Unbelievable story. Kicked out of her family at the age of 17 and pretty much on her own. Went to school at night and worked her way up the corporate ladder in Wall Street to become the global, let me get this exactly right so that I don't embarrass,
global partner.
Global partner at Invesco. Thank you. Which is about as high as you can get. That's an unbelievable achievement. She's written a couple of books to tell her stories, and we're going to talk about the second one, I believe. Patricia, welcome back. How are you doing?
I am very well, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Tell us about you were in a religious cult and your family stayed and you left. What happened when you were 17? I can't imagine anything more traumatic.
I was, in essence, truly kicked out because I wasn't going to make a good member of a religious community. I think I had too many other interests. I was a very curious person. And celibacy did not seem to be created for a life of celibacy. I was interested in boys. I was interested in the world at large. And so I found myself on my own, having been accepted at both Vassar and Bates College, where my father had gone. I found myself having to write letters saying I would not be attending. And the woman who ran the organization, Sister Catherine Clark, she allowed that she would pay for me to go to secretarial school, which I did, and then had to find a job. And my very first job was as a receptionist. But way deep down, I knew I needed more education. I yearned for more education. And so I put myself through school at night, getting an economics degree.
What kind of religious organization is this? Close to the Boston area, I can't think of what it would be.
Well, close to the Boston area, it was Catholic. But in fact, the organization was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. It's very, very doctrinaire, far right wing interpretations of Catholic dogma put them at odds with Rome, with the Pope. And it was under Pope Pius XII in 1953 that Father Feeney, the chaplain of the organization, was excommunicated, and thus by association, so were the rest of us. I was, of course, only 5 years old at the time.
My goodness. And then how did you work your way through school at night? How were you able to do that, Patricia?
Well, I had a full day, and was at Boston University. And when I moved to Philadelphia a few years later, Boston University was just tremendously wonderful and supportive. And they told me that if I took courses at Wharton or at Penn, they would accept all of them. And I must say that I had help from my, you know, the companies I worked for. They would reimburse me for half of my coursework if I did well. And I did do well, and I made every effort to do well. And so I didn't pile up a lot of debt. I did pile up some debt, and I carried that for quite some years until I was able to pay it all off. But I never found that to be a burden. What I most wanted was to get the education that I was yearning to have, and I adored every moment of it. I sometimes look back and, you know, say I never slept in a dorm, I never belonged to a sorority, but those were not with, you know, any sense of woe is me. It was just the reality of life, and I've learned to accept that the reality of my life may seem different to people, but everybody has their own exceptional life story.
Well, you certainly do. So when you graduated, when did you get your first real job on Wall Street?
Well, interestingly, I was still an undergraduate student, but I would say my first real job came when I moved to Philadelphia. And I was hired as a statistician, a perfectly legitimate role for a starting position on Wall Street. And I was working with four analysts. And then when I moved back to Boston, that was in 1974. So I was 25 years old, and I became an analyst. And then the following year, I moved to New York, and I was 26 at that time. And I moved to New York, and that's when my career really took off. I was on the brokerage side of the street for a couple of years, and then I went to the Ford Foundation, where we managed all their money. You know, all the foundation's money was managed internally. And then in 1980, I went to Citibank as the head of the capital goods research sector. And from there, a couple of years later, I became a portfolio manager. And the wonderful thing that I feel I can look back on is the mentors that I had. And I dedicate my book, Breaking Glass, with the subtitle Tales from the Witch of Wall Street. I dedicated to the mentors I had. Nearly all of them were men. Certainly, once I was out of the community and on my way for my career, they were all men. But I had one very, very important woman who was a mentor to me while I was still in high school at the Center. The Center is the name of the place that we lived. She had been a Radcliffe grad herself. Her father had been a principal, and she was the principal of our very tiny school that basically educated only the 39 children in the center. And she got wind through Sister Catherine that I would be leaving when I graduated. And she sat down with me many an afternoon, closed the door, and just quietly talked to me and said things to me I had never heard said before. And she said to me, "You are going to do very well in this world, because," she said, "you have common sense, you have a lot of energy, and you love to solve problems." And that was so heartening to me, because I was terrified of what it would be like to be on my own and to have those words always ringing in my ears, that I could do it and that she had confidence in me, gave me an enormous amount of energy as I faced the world.
Did you ever reconnect with your family?
Totally, very much so. Just 2 years after Sister Catherine kicked me out, she died. And it was an amazing blessing, frankly. And when she died, all the rest of the children started to share with their parents, whom they had not been allowed to speak to, the true stories of what was going on, the physical abuse, the emotional abuse. And the parents were stunned. My parents had no idea what was going on. And that started to break the organization apart. So I was kicked out in 1966. And by 1969, both my parents had left with two of my siblings. And over the next couple of years, the other two siblings, who had become nuns temporarily, were left the organization. And for the next 40 years, we were a family with an enormous amount of love. And people will say, well, why weren't you angry with your parents? And I think in large measure, all five of us felt the same way. There was no anger because, in fact, of our dad. And he broke the rules. And he basically went out of his way to connect with each of us, to find us on our birthdays, and we didn't even celebrate birthdays, and to let us know that he loved us. And to me, that was the glue that held me together. And when he finally got out as a 52-year-old, trying to then start a, you know, a career of his own, there was no animosity, truly no animosity.
That's amazing. You are so forgiving. It's unbelievable. How did you end up with the name The Witch of Wall Street? We talked about this before, and I remember that you weren't hurt by it. How?
Well, when I first heard that that was a moniker I had been given, it was at my 70th birthday party. Now, I'm now 77, and so I've had a lot of time to digest this. But I was horrified, and it was at my birthday party, and someone was telling it kind of as a fun story. And she said, you know, I'd heard of this woman, and I was asked to cover her as, you know, a salesperson from Bear Stearns. And while I knew of her reputation, I'd never met her. All I knew was when I went to the trading desk, they referred to her as the Witch of Wall Street. And for a while, I was really stunned and hurt and, you know, kind of tortured. How did I manage to get that moniker? And then I decided, and I accepted it because I realized that the kind of behavior that gets men rewarded, and I'm not saying this with any anger, but just the reality of the business world, men are aggressive, men impatient, men perfectionists, men want to get it done. Those are considered leadership skills. But when they're exhibited by a woman, she sometimes gets the moniker of a witch. And I decided I would revel in it. And I no longer find it dismaying. And truth be told, I know that I can be very, very aggressive and very much driven. So I can see with the benefit of hindsight why that I might be called that. I'm not sure I've completely eradicated that, but I think as I've matured, I have done my very best to find ways of not being quite as driven, or at least being more understanding of others in whatever, you know, objective I have.
Right. Well, you know, you're describing just a normal, nice business person, you know. Did you yell at people and scream at people and things like throw things and pass curses?
I certainly never, ever, ever threw anything. In fact, the kind attacking people physically was so anathema to me because that was kind of what I had seen when I was a child. But I could be immeasurably impatient, and I would be told I was yelling when, in fact, I thought, I'm just being very, very specific about things. And so I, you know, when you're young, you often don't see your faults the way others see them. And I can still to this day be very particular about what I need and want. But I think I have learned over time to use the right voice. And using the right voice can make a huge difference in getting done what you need done.
What do you mean the right voice?
Your tone of voice sends a message. It really and truly does. And I try to say, okay, can we just have this list? And I would really like it done by the end of today instead of, where's the list? Why isn't it done? What's taking so long? There are just many ways to engage, and you have to think about it a little bit, because you're going to get the best results when you work in an amicable way with people. I've come to really understand that and believe that. But when I was in my 20s and 30s, I didn't always understand that.
Yes. Very hard to see yourself.
Oh, is it ever. And even now, I think I can be more aggressive than I feel. And I think I have to constantly, because I set an objective and I want to achieve it. That is great. And that is great for being successful. On the other hand, there are other ways of achieving the same success. And sometimes a little patience, which God did not endow me with at birth, is something that you have to make an effort to learn.
Yes, very true. Did that carry over into your personal life as well?
You know what? It very much did. But you know, when I started to really learn the art and the necessity of patience was when I had my children. I was 45 years old when I gave birth to twins. And all of a sudden, it was no longer when I wanted to do something. It was when they would do something. And I saw myself slow down. It didn't mean that I lost my intellectual challenge. I just found a new way of achieving what I needed to do, which, because you can't rush children. And instead of trying to get to the airport with 1.5 minutes to spare, I suddenly realized I needed to get to the airport with 1.5 hours to spare. So you learn to bring the newspaper with you, and you learn to have toys and whatever can interest the children, and all it becomes a much less frenetic existence. And I have come to enjoy that and understand that. So I think that for me, it was an enormously advantageous experience to have my children. I suppose if I'd had them earlier, I might have learned all this earlier. But better late than never. And I do think, while I'm still driven and still love challenges, I've learned to engage with people much, much better. But I deserved that nomenclature. I really did.
So how do you advise other people to pull themselves back if they have the same issues?
Well, I think I encourage people to seek advice and engagement with someone who's more experienced than they are. And it may not be that everybody has the, you know, this, I've got to get it done now, my way, blah, blah, blah. I think very often the frustration in people can be, how can I get from point A to point B? And maybe they don't even know where point B is. But I think that looking to people that you work with or to whom you report, looking to see if they have the capabilities of mentoring you is important. Mentoring is a two-way street. And I have found so much value in the people who mentored me. And I have spent a lot of my, you know, later professional life mentoring other people. And as I say, it's a two-way street. You've got to have the person that wants to be guided, and then the other person has to be generous of spirit and be willing to take the time and have the patience to work with you. And there are plenty of potential mentors, but not everyone will be. And don't be discouraged if you run into a stone wall when you're trying to see who might be a mentor to you. But don't ever cease to ask questions and to build rapport and find someone, male or female. It doesn't matter if you're a woman, it doesn't have to be women at all. In the world of Wall Street, there were hardly any women when I started. And so I had to look for advice and counsel and direction from men, and there were plenty of them around. Today, we're lucky. There are many more kinds of professional people, and I think the advice I give to people is ask questions, seek advice, get information that helps you better yourself from those who have already learned the hard way.
What do you see in the market right now? What are your thoughts on where the market is, where it's going in the next 6 months, the next year? You know, I feel like we've been on the verge of a recession for 10 years now. They've been telling us that. but it doesn't come. Where do you think we are right now?
Well, there are some unique challenges right now. We have an environment in which we have never lived before, any of us who is alive and around, which is, a tariff environment. And those tariffs were only put into place relatively recently. And it doesn't happen tomorrow. People have to order goods. They then have to come. They then have to be priced. The sellers have to decide what they can absorb. They have to pass on what they can. But none of that is good for corporate profits. None of that is good for the pocketbook of the consumer. And I think there is a definite mode of nervousness we're seeing in the employment numbers that jobs are not, that people are not being hired. Companies are using the opportunity of retirement to just take a wait-and-see attitude. And so I think simultaneously we have the Fed that is likely to cut interest rates because they're likely to continue because they're observing that the economic environment is less positive than it was. And so sometimes when interest rates come down, that can be stimulative to the economy. The market is certainly not cheap, but I always try to advise people, if you are putting money into your 401k plan, which is the longest kind of solid investment you can make, please do not stop when the market goes down. The market going down is an opportunity to buy lower. And over time, the economy of this country should continue to have good momentum. Now we can imagine the unthinkable, but I don't think that's the best way to look at the environment. And so for those who are trying to save money for their retirement, just stick to your knitting, particularly if your entity, if your company is doing any kind of match on your 401k plan. But I wouldn't be surprised if we go through a bit of a stalling of this market until we see whether the slowdown in the economy is really going to negatively impact earnings. And I have to think it will have some impact. But we have AI, which is a huge contributor to productivity. We also have AI, which is making some jobs obsolete. So the economic environment is always dynamic, and it will continue to be. I really don't sit around timing the market. I found that over time is a very good way to lose money, because if you make one right decision, you've got to make another right decision. So you can take some money off the table, but don't be swinging, into cash and then trying to get back invested. The economy will survive. There are social changes that have an impact. We shall see what the impact of, the big beautiful bill is on healthcare. If consumers have to spend more for their healthcare, that means something else is going to have to give. So the next 6-12 months are going to be very interesting. But remember, the market is a leading indicator. That means it is looking to the future. It doesn't care about the past. So watch things like interest rates. Watch what the Fed does. Watch what the environment is for employment. And take your clues from that. But again, long term, don't try to guess the market.
Patricia, I heard you were willing to play our game, The Quick 10.
Yes, I am.
All right. Do you want to accept the wager? Do you want the wager?
Oh, what is the wager?
The bet that everyone else makes.
Oh.
That's yes. All right. Number one.
Okay. Yeah.
Your favorite creativity hack.
You know, when creativity is stopping me, I take a break. I just walk away from what I'm doing. Clear my mind, do something else, and then come back to it.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Bootstrapping, I find a business partner with talents that are different from mine, and I capitalize on that.
Number three, name your top passions.
Okay, I love business, but I love writing, I love fitness, I love to listen to the opera, I love learning from a generation that is younger than I, and I adore traveling worldwide.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
First of all, try to figure out what it's going to cost you, and then see what it will take to generate enough revenue to stay in business. Run your business strategy by someone whom you respect. Don't start out on your own. Run it by people who have had more experience, someone who's skilled in identifying what might be the flaws in your project. And don't go into a business without creating a limited liability company, an LLC. You do not want your personal assets to be at risk.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Practice on your family and friends, and then develop a marketing pitch that would impress you and try it on strangers.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
The perfect fitness tracker.
Gotta think they have that already. Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
Start small, improve your concept.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Underestimating your costs.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Sam Walton, who is the founder of Walmart. And he changed the whole nature of retailing. And he basically said, I am going to bring prices down, 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 down. And my margins are going to be tiny. And that is going to expand demand. And how right he was.
Number 10, favorite superhero.
I guess it has to be Wonder Woman.
Yes. Favorite place to visit?
Oh, anywhere in the world that I haven't been already.
Where? Where's on your list that you haven't been that you're looking forward to?
Some countries, Ghana, for example. I've never been to Ghana, and I have never been to Sweden. Now, those are at opposite ends of the world, but I would love to go to both.
And where have you been that you don't want to go back to?
Oh, my gosh, hardly any place. There is no place that I would not go back to. That is true, but I need to explore other places. The world is just, a huge basket of opportunity, culturally, language-wise. I haven't been to some very, very, very difficult countries, so I could have changed that. But honest to God, I'd love to go to Nepal. I'd love to go. I've been to Cambodia. I haven't been to Vietnam. I think it will be fantastic. So there's not a place that I would never go back to.
Excellent. I love your attitude, Patricia, about everything. How do we find out more about you, follow you online, get in touch, get a copy of your books?
You can go online. My website is patriciachadwick.com. I write a monthly blog. In fact, I'm writing one today about a woman who's turning 100 on the 26th of this month. I wrote one last month about Social Security and Medicare, which I think is very interesting. It's a very much a demographic story. But I also write other things, but it's patriciachadwick.com, and there's a whole array of things, and my books can be bought through that, or you can go to Amazon or your local bookstore and ask them to order them. So the two books are Little Sister, which was the first book, and the second is Breaking Glass, and the subtitle is Tales from the Witch of Wall Street. But the first book, Little Sister, is really a cult story, and so I think that has its own genre of interest.
Yes, and it has hundreds of five-star reviews. So we have just been giving your score on the Quick 10, Patricia. I'm very sorry. You got a 94. You have to have a 95 to win. You got a 94. One of our judges dinged you, and I don't know why. So you owe us a Tesla. You owe us a Tesla.
I owe you a Tesla?
Yeah, that's the way we play.
I would never buy a Tesla. So what am I supposed to do?
Just go to the store and put my name on it, and they'll send it here. They'll figure it out.
All right. A deal's a deal.
There you go. Patricia, I love you. You're amazing, and we thank you so much for being with us. You have the best attitude of anyone I've ever met.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's what keeps me young.
Yes. We will be right back. Welcome back to the show again. Thank you so much for being with us. I am very excited to welcome our next guest, Wayne Elliott. I have written a whole book about him, so I think I know him pretty well. He is what we all want to be, hardworking, an expert in our field, honest, good, and caring about others, and super caring about the environment. What he has done for the environment and the focus of the book, The Real Environmentalist, which I hope you buy now to honor Wayne, is that there are people like him, these silent environmental entrepreneurs that are out there starting businesses that clean up the environment. And they're doing more than the government and the associations and the speeches and all of that. And Wayne has devoted his life to the environment, first with ship recycling, getting it ISO certified, and then with battery recycling. And now his work at Strauss Naturals, bringing supplements to now the United States, Canada first, and now the U.S. Here he is, Wayne Elliott. Wayne, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Always well. Thanks, Jim. How are you doing?
I am well. All right. So the book came out yesterday, and we had a great day of sales. Congratulations. How does it feel?
Well, that's good. That's good. I hope lots of people get to read it.
I do too. All right. So
I thought you did a good job.
Oh, thank you. How are things going in Canada? What's, we've been talking about the environment and how us entrepreneurs are solving the issues. Is the government up there helping or hurting, slowing you down? What is the impact of government on the environment there?
Yeah, it's disappointing, Jim. The BlackRock company that took over our battery business, they've had no luck in 2 years now getting a penny of fees out of the, what I call the battery gangsters, Wall Streeters, not a penny. And so the collection rates are way down, and the pollution's way up. We had it at, I think our best was 54% of all batteries sold in Ontario, and I believe now it's under 20% is collected. So another, thousands of tons into the unprotected municipal landfills.
So why is it so low? Is this the same figure that was at 97 a couple of years ago?
No, it was 54%. We got the highest rate in the collection rate for sorting and recycling in the world, Ontario. That was our company did that, Raw Materials Corporation. And they stopped paying us almost 2 years before we sold the assets to BlackRock. And I really truthfully thought, because I fought with them for 40 years over there, not being serious about recycling, in fact, demoting recycling. And I thought that the 360, the BlackRock company, would do well when they took over. I thought it was these guys' hate for me. No, it's just their hate for recycling. And so that continues to go on. And boy, that bothered me. It's literally thousands of tons just every year, or at least until things improve. In Ontario, thousands of tons a year more go into the ground in unprotected municipal landfills in your kitchen trash. Excuse me. And that's a crying shame as far as I'm concerned. All the work that went into those 5,200 collection sites and the government finally fined the major manufacturers $1 million each. That was months ago. And in Ontario here, you would have 30 days to let the government know if you intend to appeal. So called to Recycles, said to the government, could we have till the end of the year to let you know? Government said, sure you can. So everything just gets delayed another 6 months. I believe they'll appeal and then drag their feet for years. And I believe the government won't recharge them like they have the right to do. They can charge them every day. They won't. I guess these manufacturers have clout with the government. It's crazy that it took 4 years to levy a fine when they knew 5 years ago there were big issues. So the government is lax here. There's a big difference between Canada and the United States. I mean, especially your feds can't mess with the U.S. feds. They all got guns and badges and very serious. The fines are tremendous in the U.S. Years ago, the Exide Corporation got, I believe it was 5 fines for typos on hazardous waste manifests. It wasn't trying to throw the government off or call something that it wasn't. It was typos. And they proposed a fine of $6 million, the EPA did, and the company settled for, I forget what it was a lot of money, for 6 typos. And here in Canada, you'd never get in trouble for that. You'd probably be asked to correct it, and there'd be no other repercussions. So I think it's a disgrace that they've given them another 6 months to say whether or not they're going to appeal the fines. And they do have the ability to fine them every day, but they'll never do that. So, yeah, the government at this point in this case, and, you know, it's not just the batteries. Same thing happened with electronics. The government just won't enforce the rules against the big companies. And so I guess we're going backwards now. All that work for 40 years, and now we're going backwards. I never thought the clock would go backwards, but it is. So, yeah, I'm not too happy about that. I feel as though a lot of work was wasted and just criminal to continue to bury these things. In my opinion, it's criminal. That's the way I feel about it. So, no, I'm not happy at all about it. I'm ashamed of our government, and I think it's a disgrace what they're not doing. So what I expect, what I truly expect, is the battery people will drag their feet for 4 or 5 years and these fines before they get to court. And then it will become a cost of doing business. Every few years, get a fine and continue to landfill the stuff. That's what I believe. I have no faith whatsoever in that group. 40 years is proof enough, Jim.
the example you gave about the typo is just ridiculous. I mean, any normal, nice person would just say, hey, you have a typo here, let's fix that. And to do otherwise is just, you know, power gone to someone's head.
That's in the U.S. That's in the U.S. That's how serious your feds are, right?
I know.
So there's certainly a deterrent in the United States from behaving like that. In Canada, it's just far less serious, it appears, or maybe it just depends who you are and how much clout you have with the government. I don't know. But for the environment, no, the clock's gone backwards here in Canada now. Very sad for me.
For how long? Is that for just the last couple of years, or is it...
Well, no, it started when they stopped paying our company fees 4 years ago. They owed us millions at the time. They didn't pay, and they just stopped paying the fees. So we lost millions operating, and now it's 2 years that the new operator's been running without a penny from the program. And yet, here's the fraud part of it, Jim. Every Ontario citizen, or if you're from somewhere else and you buy a battery in Ontario, they actually had the nerve to raise the price, the recycling fee on alkaline batteries from 5 to 6 cents. So they raised the cost to the public, lowered the collection and recycling dramatically. And so to my view, that's fraud. If you and I did that, defrauding the public like that, we would go to prison. These guys are getting their knuckles slapped with a fine. $1 million sounds like a lot. These are billion-dollar companies. It's nothing. It's like the tax on lunch. And I don't think it's much of a deterrent. And there, of course, as time goes on, they realize they can just push the government around with very little repercussions. So I don't have any hope. It just makes me feel terrible. And it feels like my 40 years was wasted, and I hate that. I hate that. We built a world-class business, world-class technology, best demonstrated technology in the world. And these environmental criminals, you know, want to see it end. That was our crime. We did way too good a job, Jim. They didn't want collections that high. They stopped us from getting new clients for 2 years before they even controlled the stewardship program. But as the stewards, they got Stewardship Ontario to get us to stop it. Six salespeople counting the president. And we couldn't pick up one new account for 2 years because we were collecting too much. And in the spirit of the law, in the spirit of the regulation, how is it possible to collect too much waste and keep it out of the landfills? I think even these targets, which the battery manufacturers treat as maximums, they're supposed to be minimums. The target should be 100%. I think I might have said before on your show, how'd you like to play for a baseball team, Jim, whose goal is to win half the games? I don't want to play for a loser team like that. The goal's got to be winning all the games. And this goal should be 100% recycling if we're serious about it. But the government's shown they're not serious about it. And if they're not going to enforce more strictly than they are, I mean, it's good these fines came out, but then give them over 6 months to decide if they're going to appeal them or not. It's just another delay. But, it's sad for me. Very sad. Very sad. It's criminal. It's criminal. And they continue to take the money from the public. You can't buy a battery in Ontario without paying that recycling fee.
Yep. So what is the solution to this problem? Is it changing the government officials that you elect, or is it a bureaucratic issue that's going to stay there basically forever? Is it one person?
I don't know. No. Well, you would think the Minister of Environment, but governments change, and he visited the plant, the minister did a few years ago. Thought it was great, lovely, wonderful, great what you're doing, and then did nothing for 4 years. So I think it's the old Wall Street shuffle. It's who you know, and you can threaten all these jobs. If it were me, I'd be saying, listen, you want to sell your batteries in Ontario? Your target's 100%. Now do your best every year. No more 40% this year and then 45%. We already broke those. We were already well over that when they put these targets in for them. So they got, 4 years to turn the clock back. And instead of collecting 54%, 40 was their target. First, they gave them 2 years grace after they're misbehaving for decades. And I really hope in the United States, in California, that's finally passed this. Took five tries because of the battery industry. Took five tries over many years. They visited our plant, a big entourage with a senator and a congressman and a whole bunch of environment people. During COVID, they did. 33 of them came to our plant to see for themselves there actually was a process that worked. So I hope in California they get serious with these people and set good targets and enforce them and find these guys. You start finding them $1 million a day, that's a different story now. You're going to get some attention. And that's what I hope happens to them. I mean, Jim, if they were serious about battery recycling, why do only 4 or 5 out of 51 states have programs? Well, 40 years at it, and you've got 5 states out of 51 or 50. If they want to say they've made an honest effort, they're the biggest losers I've ever heard of in my life. My grandchildren could have done better, and the oldest one's 8. So, you know, I'm disgusted. I guess you can tell. I'm just disgusted. I'm ashamed. I hate being ashamed of being a Canadian. It's not the first time. And our politicians pushing President Trump, and it doesn't matter what you think of President Trump, this is not a man who you push his buttons and poke at him. That's what we've been doing. They're talking about Canada's going to have new markets. We got to do Asia and Europe. We've been tied to the U.S. for too long. And everybody's getting, the politicians all getting all ramped up about that. And I think they forgot, Jim, there's an ocean. To get to Europe, there's an ocean called the Atlantic. To get to Asia, there's an ocean called the Pacific. And it costs a fortune to cross those oceans. So you may be able to ship your goods and your oil and so forth across the ocean, but it isn't free. And you'll wish you had the deal back with the United States. But this is the way our politicians are talking. He's just this new prime minister that really didn't get elected. I don't know how they slid this guy in. Former Bank of England chairman and the former Bank of Canada chairman. Never been a politician, but anyway, he is recognizing, as is England and Australia, recognizing the Palestinian state. And, of course, that's not going to make President Trump happy. And I just wish they had been smarter in dealing with your president. I mean, our two countries are the best friend neighbors in the world's history. And this is nonsense that's going on. And, you know, as if we're going to fight the United States and fight President Trump, we got a better chance of I don't know what. But we can't win that fight. And I think they just need somebody with brains and common sense to go and meet with the man. I wish I could go meet with him.
That'd be an interesting conversation. But, what would you...
It sure would be.
Wayne, what would you do if you could go back 60 years and live your life again? What differences would you make? Would you still go into the same industries? Would you just go ahead and move to America 60 years ago? What would you have done if you could start over?
Yeah, I wish we had a good opportunity back when I was a late teen in Brownsville, Texas. And the only reason my dad didn't take the deal for he and I was my mother was afraid I'd be drafted. The Vietnam conflict was still going on. And she was afraid I would get sent to the Army. And that was the reason we didn't do it. But if I had it to do over again, I think about this all the time now, Jim. Never gone into the battery business. As much as I love the ships, and did right since I was a kid, probably wouldn't have gone into the shipbreaking business. And I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have made it a family business. I should have told my boys, go and get work somewhere. Go to school as long as you want and get out and get work somewhere and prove you can, and then maybe we'll talk about working together. That's what I should have done. So I hate feeling this way at year 54 of a business career. But, yeah, I have some regrets. Trusting the government was another one. I thought we could trust the government. You can't trust the government to do what's right. I'd love to have lunch with President Trump, though. First, I'd bust his chops about the War of 1812. and then I'd say we don't want to fight anymore, though, so let's just be good friends. I'd give you 2-1 odds on a buck. I'd come home with a deal we could swallow. But I sure wouldn't go down there and poke that bear. And that's what we have done. Canadians have done. So I don't know where it's going to end up, Jim, but, and I don't even know if the tariffs have actually kicked in yet. I honestly don't. This very high tariffs on aluminum, steel, and automobiles, I don't know if it's taken effect. But I'll tell you, when and if it does, with the numbers that President Trump's talking about, it'll shut some of these mills down, I believe. We've been very closely tied together economically, our two countries. And, you know, Canadians are outraged. I think the thing that bothered them the most was this becoming the 51st state business. And President Trump said that, you know, then we wouldn't need a Defense Department. you know, that it would be quite a country if we got together, you
the
know.
The average Canadian hates the idea, right?
I'd say 90% of them, yep. Yep. They're so, the average Canadian hates President Trump. They think he's nuts, he's a crook, he's the first real businessman that's ever, as far as I know, that's ever been the boss of the President of the United States. And like him or not, my opinion, he's doing some smart things. Maybe the way he goes about it is, you know, could change. But I think he makes some good points. And I'm not a political guy. I just wish the government would do its job. All the money they take from us here in Canada, it's just outrageous, the income tax and stuff. And yet we got such a huge debt, it's pathetic. We got a debt the size of your debt per capita. And as I've half-joked before, we couldn't defend our side of Lake Erie, much less our coastlines. So, and I don't blame America for being upset with us and the other 20 countries that have not met their NATO obligations. And now President Trump's demanded that those countries, including Canada, spend 5% of their GDP, not 2%, which we failed at miserably for decades at 2%. So they say the 5% is going to cost Canada another $150 billion a year. And for less than that $150 billion, at the time when Prime Minister Harper approved the naval new construction of our Navy, it was $30 billion. Now they say it's $150 billion. And if we, you know, if we, whether we do it or not, President Trump wants us to spend that extra $150 billion every year on defense. So I don't know if the plan is to bankrupt Canada, but I think I don't really think it's President Trump's plan. I'm starting to believe it's our politicians' plan. And I don't know what the, except that our new prime minister is a one world order guy, a reset guy. And I honestly think this, they've announced 6 mega projects for tens of billions each. This is the answer to the situation with the United States.
What kind of projects?
And the natives are up in arms because they won't be, their approval won't be sought, whether things go over their lands or not. So it's not going to work. Our natives are very powerful in Canada. Definitely the most powerful group in Canada is our First Nations people. So just another horse and pony show in Canada. Feed the cat another canary.
Yep. Wayne, I appreciate you being with us today and shooting the S. And I hope the book sells well. And thank you for your help with it. It was fun.
Yep. Thanks, Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep. We are out of time. Back tomorrow. Be safe. Take care. Go make $1 million. Bye now.